From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the vote to secede in eastern Ukraine. South Sudan peace talks might be on in Addis Ababa. Latest on the Nigeria schoolgirl kidnappings, plus the Java Jazz Festival tribute to George Duke. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Russia has ordered energy-dependent Ukraine to pay in advance for all future natural gas deliveries. It comes as cash-poor Kiev government struggles to maintain economic and political stability. And in another development, pro-Russian insurgents in eastern Ukraine decided on Thursday to go ahead with that referendum on autonomy, despite a call Wednesday from Russian President Vladimir Putin to delay the voting. Jamie Detmer is in Donetsk with our report.
In yet another twist in the weeks-long Ukraine crisis, insurgent leaders in the east of the country say although they respect Russia President Vladimir Putin's request to hold off voting on whether to secede from Ukraine, they cannot comply. Rebel leader Denis Pushilin says the insurgents understand Mr. Putin cares for the people of southeastern Ukraine. But we are the bullhorn of the people, he says, adding people in the east won't accept the government in Kiev, and that there was a unanimous decision by the insurgency leaders to go ahead with Sunday's referendum. The decision by the separatists to proceed with the vote comes as a poll by US-based Pew Research, released Thursday, found a majority of Ukrainians want the country to remain a single, unified state, with 93% in the pro-European West favouring a retention of the current borders of the country. The survey reports that 70% of those polled in the troubled East also back unity. But another insurgent leader, Mislav Rudenko, believes the vote on May the 11th will result in a vote to break from Ukraine. He says the decision to go ahead with the referendum was an expression of the people's will and shows democracy in action. Wednesday's appeal by Russian President Putin urging Moscow-backed separatists to hold off on their vote came as a surprise. The interim government in Kiev appeared divided on how to respond, with some ministers welcoming the request, saying it could create the conditions for dialogue. But others are suspicious. They accuse the Russian leader of wanting to weaken Ukraine by splitting the country into semi-autonomous parts that could more easily be manipulated and dominated by Moscow. Mr. Putin on Wednesday not only urged for a postponement of the referendum, but also called on Kiev to stop a military campaign aimed at restoring order in the east. However, top Ukraine security officials say they have no intention of halting their operations. They claim Moscow is fomenting the uprising in the region, and they are having a difficult time stemming the violence in major flashpoint towns throughout the east.
No, it's a complete misunderstanding.
Like all the separatist leaders in the east, Valery Bolotov, the separatist leader in Luhansk, insists Moscow doesn't pull the strings when it comes to the uprising. The insurgency is an expression of the people's will, he says. Some individual Russians help with money, he says. With Sunday's vote now going ahead, Ukrainians are braced for more conflict. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Donetsk.
President Putin is due to travel to China later this month, hoping to seal energy deals and build diplomatic relations amid a souring of relations between Moscow and the West. But analysts say he may struggle to win allies in his war of words with the United States and Europe over the violence in Ukraine. Henry Ridgewell has our story.
Tensions are flaring on Russia's western borders as pro-Moscow separatists in Ukraine battle government forces loyal to Kiev. On the opposite side of Russia, its Asian neighbours are watching with concern. Beijing, in particular, is rattled, says Professor Arne Westad, director of the Ideas Policy Group at the London School of Economics.
I think the Russians, in part, got the Chinese views on this wrong. I mean, China's policy is still emphasising non-intervention and sovereignty. So this has been a difficult one for China.
Russian President Vladimir Putin will travel to Beijing later this month. Chinese President Xi Jinping chose Moscow for his first foreign trip last year, signing a raft of energy deals. Russia aims to triple oil exports to China, and analysts say growing tensions over Ukraine are forcing Moscow to look for gas markets outside Europe, with President Putin aiming to sign off on building a pipeline to China. But it's far from a done deal, says Natasha Kurt of King's College London.
It's going to have a hard time doing that because China also likes to ensure that it has a diversity of supply.
Kurt says Moscow will also find it difficult to gain support from Beijing over its stance on Ukraine.
They'll be much more cautious. I mean, I think one always has to beware of, you know, the kind of rhetoric that is, you know, wheeled out for domestic consumption within Russia. Essentially, China will not really cozy up to Russia.
China is wary of upsetting relations with other global powers, says LSE's Westad.
Not least in terms of China's own economic interests, it's Washington that counts. So you can't go too far in supporting a policy that not just the Americans, but the Europeans too, very important for the Chinese in terms of their economic development, see as completely outrageous.
East Asia's other economic power, Japan, has imposed visa restrictions on some Russian officials. Visiting Brussels this week, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe reiterated his country's alliance with Europe. Mr. Abe said Ukraine shows that the world is getting less predictable, and Japan and the European Union are responsible for taking a very proactive role together towards world peace. Japan disputes the ownership of the northern Kuril Islands, controlled since 1945 by the Soviet Union and then Russia. Tokyo may seek to draw parallels with Ukraine, says Professor Anna Westad.
There are some similarities in seen from a Japanese perspective in terms of Russian behavior when it comes to these kinds of possessions.
As its relations with the West turn sour, analysts say Moscow will find it difficult to build alliances in the East amid the continuing unrest in Ukraine. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
And you can keep up to date on what's happening in Ukraine, plus the world's reaction, by going to our website, voanews.com.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Head of the UN agency overseeing Syria's chemical weapons destruction, Sigrid Kaag, spoke with reporters Thursday about the removal so far.
Including destruction in country, we've reached a significant progress, 92%. However, there is concern, and that we've also expressed as a joint mission, that the remaining 8% is currently inaccessible due to the security conditions in country.
Kaag met on Thursday in a closed-door session with the Security Council. Afterwards, she said it's critical to ensure that Syria meets the June 30th deadline for ridding itself of all chemical weapons.
Significant milestones have been met, but we do need that final push to achieve 100% and to complete the work as foreseen in the entire chemical weapons elimination program.
And in Washington on Thursday, the head of Syria's main opposition group, Ahmed Jarba, said his talks with Secretary of State John Kerry and other top officials will bear fruit for the Syrian people. The United States this week recognized Jarba's Syrian National Coalition as a diplomatic foreign mission. Also in the news, at least four countries, including the U.S., have pledged to assist Nigeria in the search for those 276 missing schoolgirls who were kidnapped by the militant group Boko Haram. Addressing the World Economic Forum summit on Thursday in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, President Goodluck Jonathan spoke about the international help to find the girls.
The United States of America, the United Kingdom, and France have also spoken with me and have expressed their commitment to help us resolve this crisis in Nigeria. I believe that the kidnap of these girls will be the beginning of end of terror in Nigeria.
President Jonathan said those attending the forum were showing their support for the country and dealing a major blow to the terrorist. One terrorism expert says despite horrific acts of brutality carried out by Boko Haram in Nigeria, the biggest international terrorist threat continues to emanate from the Middle East, specifically Syria, Iraq, and Yemen. Greg Barton is acting director of the Center for Islam and the Modern World at Australia's Monash University. He spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about the issue. He notes that there is Jabhat al-Nusra, which operates with rebel forces in Syria, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which reportedly controls the city of Fallujah in Iraq, and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, based in Yemen. As for Boko Haram, which has attacked schools, churches, mosques, police stations, and markets while seeking to establish strict Islamic law in the Muslim-majority northern Nigeria, Barton says most attacks are confined to Nigeria. He says the government has shown it is capable of dealing with the threat and, in fact, bears some of the blame for the group's violent turn in 2009.
This is a group that only came into formation about a dozen years ago. It only turned violent and self-consciously became jihadi in 2009, just 5 years ago. And in part that was because of response to police brutality. There was an incident in which as many as 700 Boko Haram members died in police custody. Now, the group itself has behaved in a most barbarous fashion, and nothing we say about it can excuse its behavior. But we need to look at what drives a group like this in surviving in a society that doesn't like it. Boko Haram is very unpopular in Nigeria. It doesn't reflect traditional Nigerian understandings of Islam. No one wants them around. Their behavior is completely horrible. So how could they possibly recruit and grow? And so far, it's been partly because of inept police and military responses and often heavy-handed, overly brutal responses that leave family members responding to the death of a loved one by signing up with the group. So we should be very careful about isolating these groups in society and diminishing the power to reproduce themselves and slowly try and bring them under control in terms of their recruiting. And to do that, it's the hearts and minds piece. We need to get general society on board and protect those who are vulnerable to reprisals and protect those who are vulnerable to being preyed upon for recruiting.
You've noticed now the international response. Do you expect this to become an international fight in Nigeria?
I think the U.S. is torn between two impulses here. And the one, there's a very natural impulse, to desire to try and help. I mean, schoolgirls being taken hostage, possibly to be sold off as slaves or into marriage. You can't think of a more horrible image that should rightly evoke a response. So the U.S. And other nations naturally want to try and do something. U.S. Special Forces could do something very useful on the ground. On the other hand, there's no desire for this to be a U.S. military operation. So more in the realm of giving technical assistance, helping the Nigerian military police locate Boko Haram groups and locate their hostages, and then helping them move in a way that minimizes loss of life. The potential for this to end up like the siege of Waco is very high. And of course, Waco occurred in America, so even in the world's most advanced military power, authorities can make mistakes and make matters worse. So I think it's right that America should be involved and other nations, and I think we'll see increasing attention on Boko Haram. But we need to look at the structural issues that made it possible for this group to emerge and work with the Nigerian state to try and diminish those weaknesses in the state. And it's not simply a case of poverty, it's not simply a case of inequity, but the fact that the northeast of Nigeria has proven fairly fertile for this group to operate means that more needs to be done on local security and on addressing local grievances and providing other ways of getting young people into meaningful employment so that they're not at a loose end and prey to being recruited by such groups.
Greg Barton is acting director of the Center for Islam and the Modern World at Australia's Monash University. He was speaking with my colleague Victor Beatty. South Sudanese rebel leader Riek Machar has arrived in Addis Ababa for his first direct talks with South Sudan's president Salva Kiir since fighting and ethnic violence erupted back in December. Negotiations between the rebel and government delegations have dragged on now for several months with little progress. The unrest was sparked by a power dispute between President Kiir and Machar. Amnesty International is saying that now that both sides in South Sudan's conflict have committed horrific atrocities against civilians. It says the attacks have been ethnically motivated and amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity. VOA's Joda Capua reports.
The rights group has released the results of its investigation called Nowhere Safe, Civilians Under Attack in South Sudan. Amnesty International's Deputy Director for Africa, Michelle Kagari, says deliberately attacking civilians is a war crime.
We found consistently wherever we went, whether it was a conflict area where the government troops were in control or whether it was the armed opposition that were in control, civilians had been specifically targeted and they had been killed. We found evidence of abductions, evidence of rape, including rape of women who were pregnant and young girls, which is an additional crime.
She says there is also evidence of the killing of soldiers who had laid down their weapons and were no longer taking part in the fighting. Kagari says there are no safe havens, even in places typically considered sanctuaries.
We found that there was no regard whatsoever to the protection that these places have and that civilians were being targeted and killed in hospitals, in churches, and within the UNMISS bases. And all these are war crimes.
When fighting started last December, many observers, NGO officials, and international leaders refrained from calling it an ethnic-based conflict. But Kagari says a tipping point has been reached since then. She notes that South Sudan's own Human Rights Commission said earlier this year that the ethnic dimensions of the conflict cannot be ignored.
Certainly, when we went on the ground, that seemed to be the primary motivation for killings. So people were being killed on the basis that they were either Nuer or Dinka or Shilluk. And the political affiliation had certainly become secondary. And that would have been a shift maybe as opposed to when the conflict first started in December.
The Amnesty International report says civilians are frightened and traumatized.
We had one civilian tell us that South Sudan is destroyed. There's nothing left. Everything they have has been destroyed, which is another war crime. There has been deliberate looting and razing of villages. And the looting has been so widespread. One person told us that she left in advance of the pro-government forces. And when she went back, her house was completely cleaned. And this was pretty similar with everywhere else in that neighborhood.
Kagari says UN compounds are sheltering only a small number of South Sudan's displaced. If they leave those areas, they are subject to attack and gang rape. She says UNMISS forces lack the capacity to protect civilians just outside compound walls.
We would like UNMISS's mandate to change so that there's much stronger focus on protection of civilians. We would also like the Security Council resolution that was passed in December to be fully enforced so that UNMISS has the capacity to ensure protection of civilians.
Most of the hundreds of thousands of displaced South Sudanese are in the countryside.
They are not able to plant. Now, if they are not able to plant, they are not able to get their food, then really we're looking at famine being inevitable if they're not able to plant by the end of this month.
The rainy season is making many roads impassable, meaning food truck convoys cannot reach those in need. She says both the African Union and UN should investigate and document cases of potential war crimes, but evidence may be washing away.
We are concerned that with the rains, evidence of these crimes is being lost. We already found that a number of sites where there had been mass killings, bodies had already been buried and the evidence is already being lost. So we are really concerned that investigations should be expedited in order to ensure that there is accountability for these crimes.
Amnesty International says all parties to the conflict must immediately cease all violations of international human rights and humanitarian law, and allow unfettered access for humanitarian assistance to those in need. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and
civilians.
Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
This with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
It hasn't been that long since we told you about the passing of one of America's top musical talents. George Duke, singer, composer, keyboard pioneer, an all-around great guy, died last August on the 5th. He was 67 years old. Recently, at the Java Jazz Festival in Indonesia, a number of fellows who played with Duke throughout his years in the business gathered to pay tribute to this amazing musician. Here is some of that tribute. Just going to interrupt the music just for a second to thank everyone for tuning into the Voice of America today and for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, you can find us anytime on the internet at voanews.com. And we hope that you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday. Now, a bit more of that tribute to George Duke at this year's Java Jazz Festival.
This is Today in History. On May 9, 1914, President Woodrow Wilson issued a proclamation asking Americans to give a public expression of reverence to mothers through the celebration of Mother's Day. The proclamation set aside the second Sunday of May as National Mother's Day in the U.S. In 1941, the Royal Navy captured the German submarine U-110, including one of the Second World War's great secrets, an Enigma cipher machine and code books. The find allowed British intelligence agents to decipher coded German messages during the war. In 1950, French Foreign Minister Robert Schuman proposed that France and other West European countries share their coal and steel resources. The so-called Schuman Declaration led to creation of the European Coal and Steel Community, a forerunner of today's European Union. On this day in 1961, Newton Minow, chairman of the Federal Communications Commission that oversees the U.S. broadcast industry, said, quoting now, "When television is good, nothing is better. But when television is bad, nothing is worse." The so-called vast wasteland speech to broadcasters aimed at encouraging responsible programming. On May 9, 1974, the U.S. House of Representatives Judiciary Committee officially opened impeachment hearings against President Richard Nixon. It would vote to impeach or charge the president on three counts related to the Watergate scandal. Mr. Nixon resigned his office in August before his case went to trial in the Senate. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During his 2013 State of the Union address, President Barack Obama called for the eradication of extreme poverty worldwide by the year 2030. One of the keys to achieving this goal is to prevent and control diseases that disproportionately burden the poor. This includes vector-borne illnesses, those transmitted by mosquitoes, flies, ticks, and bugs, such as neglected tropical diseases. Over 1 billion people suffer from one or more neglected tropical diseases, or NTDs. Sometimes also called diseases of the forgotten people, these illnesses affect mostly people living in rural areas and urban slums of low-income countries. They are most common wherever access to clean water and sanitation is lacking, and where children suffer from malnutrition. NTDs are devastating both to those who suffer from them and to their communities. Many of these diseases can impair intellectual development in children, reduce school enrollment, and hinder economic productivity of entire communities by limiting the ability of infected individuals to work. These usually treatable and preventable diseases include schistosomiasis, elephantiasis, trachoma, Chagas disease, river blindness, leprosy, Kala Azar, dengue, black fever, and other forms of leishmaniasis. And the three most common infections, the soil-transmitted parasites, hookworm, roundworm, and whipworm. Together, they cause as much damage as HIV, malaria, or tuberculosis. The United States has been a part of the global effort to control these diseases since 2006. Then, 2 years ago, working through the U.S. Agency for International Development, the U.S. government joined Uniting to Combat Neglected Tropical Diseases, a partnership that also includes the governments of the United Kingdom and United Arab Emirates, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the World Bank, 13 pharmaceutical companies, and other global health organizations dedicated to accelerating progress toward eliminating or controlling 10 NDTs by the end of the decade. As of 2012, the USAID NTD program has supported the delivery of 820 million treatments globally. Controlling and perhaps eventually eliminating these diseases cannot be achieved by one group or one country acting alone. The problem is too widespread, too complex, and must be attacked on many levels. It will require much effort, funding, and political will. Only by working together can we hope to overcome these ancient causes of human misery and improve the lives of over 1 billion people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.